100.3 WNOX is proud to present The Veteran Next Door. Here's your host, Randall Baxter.
You're listening to The Veteran Next Door, and I'm your host, Randy Baxter. What if you went to work one day and didn't get to come home and you were still alive? In planning for the show today, I was going through the list of people that I have met and interviewed who were prisoners of war. I've introduced you to a couple of them already. John Schell, who got captured at the Battle of the Bulge when the German paratroopers dropped down on him and 30 of his compatriots. Mr. Tillman, who got captured as a young man a week or so after his brother was captured, and their mother received a letter saying that they had both been captured, and she went into her bedroom for 20 minutes by herself and came out and said, "They'll be all right." We talked about the other day Mr. Chatfield, who as a young man was captured in Korea and marched to the Manchurian border and held prisoner all winter and fed millet and sorghum, and he starved to death or died from dysentery. And then there's the ones that you're going to meet soon, like the longest held prisoner of war in American history, longest held non-commissioned officer, and maybe soon a survivor of the Bataan Death March, or even a young black man who lived in Memphis and got into a fight with a white man and was afraid he was going to go to prison, so he joined the army and fought in the Korean War and got captured and was afraid to come home, so he went to China. Prisoners of war and those missing in action from all U.S. wars. It starts with the War of the American Revolution. There were 18,152 prisoners of war, with 1,426 missing in action. They were treated at the time not as prisoners of war, but as traitors to the king. And then, a couple years later, the War of 1812. And most of the prisoners of war, of which there were 20,000, almost the same amount as the Revolutionary War, but a lot of them were sailors taken on the open sea. No one respected the American Navy, but we showed them a little bit later. Then there was the Alamo. And this is a battle that we fought that we knew there would be no prisoners of war. Only a few survivors. In the Mexican War, we didn't have many prisoners. There were 46 prisoners of war. But we did have a little conflict where American soldiers during that war switched sides, left the American army, and fought for the Mexicans, mostly because the Mexicans were Catholic, so were they, and they were Irish. When they were captured, somebody had to hang. Then there were the Indian Wars, and our prisoner of wars were treated a little. They weren't treated the same as the Revolution or the Mexican War. We had our own version of ethnic cleansing during the Indian Wars. And in the Civil War, well, there were 400,000 prisoners of war, about 200,000 on each side. And they weren't treated the best by each side, but we'll just talk about that here in a little bit. Then there was the Spanish-American War, where there were only 8 prisoners of war, but that was a short war. In World War I, 7,470. In World War II, 124,000. And after World War II came the Cold War era, where we couldn't always admit that our soldiers were captured. So if you go to the Cold War era and look at the report I'm looking at, the prisoners of war information is classified. And we've talked about them. Some of them were airplane pilots or flying on the Russian border, and they were checking the response time of the Russian Air Force, and occasionally they would get shot down. We know in our history books of about 200 of them. In the Korean War, 7,140, in which 45% starved to death. And we all know about the Vietnam War. There weren't that many prisoners of war, 766, but we had 1,719 missing in action. And the USS Pueblo, 83 of our sailors were captured and held prisoner. Grenada and the USS Stark, we had some missing in action, but no prisoners of war. And in the Persian Gulf War, there were 29 prisoners of war. And they weren't used as, they weren't accused of being traitors, and they weren't accused of being anything, but lots of times they were used as human shields. In Somalia, we had 6 captured. You've seen the movie. Yugoslavia, we had 3. And today we don't hear many prisoners of war. We do have a few that are being held. We're going to talk about those later on in the show. So there are lots of reasons that we have POWs, and lots of different reasons countries would treat them differently. It's not always the same. But we do have our own attitudes and beliefs about how a prisoner of war should be treated. We don't always follow it, but we do think that they should be treated fairly and safely. This is our topic today. We'll be talking about more about the prisoners of war. You're listening to The Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll be right back.
The Veteran Next Door will return in a moment here on 100.3 WNOX.
Sun up on a cool, sweet morning. Sausage frying in the pan. Make that sausage always Wamplers. It's the finest in the land. Wamplers, Wamplers, it's great sausage made on the farm in Tennessee. Don't say sausage, just say Wamplers for the best in quality. Make that sausage always Wamplers. It's the best in quality.
Hello, this is Randy Baxter, the host of the Veteran Next Door radio program. I'm also an advocate for U.S. senior vets. This next announcement is important to our listeners who have a parent or spouse who have served at least one day in the U.S. military during wartime. If this is you, please pay attention to this next announcement.
Do you have a grandparent, a parent, an aunt, an uncle, a sibling, a spouse who is a veteran of our armed forces and represented our country during wartime? The Aid in Attendance Benefit is a little-known Veterans Administration benefit offered to our heroes who fought in our wars. This benefit is also available to spouses of these same veterans. You must qualify for this benefit by submitting an application by meeting the criteria for qualification. For free information helping you find out if you qualify for this benefit, call 865-525-2323. You will receive the basic information to qualify for this benefit, as well as the next step procedures for application. Not all veterans qualify, but you need to be sure that you know what this benefit is all about so you will know when that time comes. Many family members may be suffering from the wear and tear and expense expense of providing services and care to a loved one who qualifies for this economic support. Take the first step. There is no cost to you to find out. Get your free information in the mail. Call 865-525-2323. There is no cost for this information. Just call and you will receive it in the mail. No salesman will call. World War II, Korean and Vietnam veterans, and even our veterans from the Middle Eastern wars can qualify, but not if you don't take the first step. 525-2323. This service is provided by the sponsors of the Veteran Next Door radio show and is not working in association with the Veterans Administration. This service is free to all veterans.
Make plans to attend the 5th Annual Mountain Man Memorial March in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, April 20th through the 21st, 2012. The march is a unique way to show your support for our troops and honor those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice for our country. For more information, visit theveterannextdoor.com and click on the Mountain Man Memorial March web link. That's theveterannextdoor.com and click on the Mountain Man Memorial March web link.
Now back to the Veteran Next Door on 100.3 WNOX.
Welcome back to the Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter. Prisoners of war, they've been treated differently in almost every war that the American people have ever had. In the Revolutionary War, there were exchanges of prisoners. These were made in the field or at higher levels of organization. Usually high-ranking officer exchanges were negotiated for specifically named people. There were some exchanges based on numbers for random lower-ranking people, but these were limited. Three other aspects were different from those normally seen in modern warfare. The first is that letters were permitted and sometimes even encouraged. Prisoners could buy or exchange for food and clothing, including any money sent by their families. The second was the use of parole by both sides. This would allow prisoners some freedom in exchange for their promise not to resume the war. The last is that prisoners were encouraged to enlist in the army on the other side. Over the course of the Revolutionary War, as much as 25% of each army had actually seen service on the other side. King George III of Great Britain had declared American forces traitors in 1775, which denied them prisoner of war status. However, British strategy in early conflict included pursuit of a negotiated settlement, and therefore officials declined to try and or hang the traitors, which was the usual procedure for treason. This was to avoid unnecessarily risking any public sympathy the British might have enjoyed in the Americas. The Continental Army captured of a British army at the Battle of Saratoga in 1777 resulted in thousands of British prisoners in the hands of the Americans. This had the effect of further dissuading British officials from hanging prisoners, despite the abandoned hopes of a settlement by this stage. But during the American Revolutionary War, management and treatment of prisoners of war was very different from the standards of modern warfare. Modern standards, as outlined in the Geneva Conventions, expect captives to be held and cared for by their captors. One primary difference in the 18th century was that care and supplies for captives were expected to be provided by their own army, their government, or private resources. The British forces held relatively few places in strength for long periods of time. American prisoners tended to be accumulated at those sites. New York City was a major site of occupation where sugar houses were used to detain prisoners. Philadelphia in 1777 and later Charleston, South Carolina were also important facilities at these places, but the spaces were limited. At times, the occupying army was actually larger than the total civilian population. The British solution to this problem was to use obsolete, captured, or damaged ships as prisons. Conditions were appalling, and many more Americans died of neglect while in prison than were killed in the war. While the Continental Army named a commissary to supply them, the task was almost impossible. Elias Bonneau, as one of these commissaries, was competing with other agents seeking to gather supplies for George Washington's army at Valley Forge. When the Revolutionary War was over, the British had another adversary rise up and cause them trouble. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. And in 1805, Great Britain was at war with Napoleonic France, a conflict during which thousands of prisoners were taken and confined in prison hulks or derelict ships, just like the Revolutionary War. This was considered unsafe, partially due to the proximity of the Royal Navy Dockyard at Plymouth, and as living conditions were appalling in the extreme, a prisoner of war depot was planned in the remote isolation of a town called Dartmoor. That's Dartmoor. The British built the facility, and in 1809, the first French prisoners arrived and were joined by American POWs taken in the War of 1812. At one time, the prison population numbered almost 6,000. Many prisoners died and were buried on the moor. Both French and American wars were concluded in 1815, and repatriations began. But before the war was over, the starving American sailors and most of the prisoners of war in Dartmoor were American seamen who had been confiscated on the open seas. A bread wagon was at this moment making a delivery to the stores, and there was a fear that the prisoners might attempt to take control. Captain Shortland went at the head of his soldiers and ordered all the prisoners back. The prisoners refused. Again, the order was given to return while the soldiers fixed bayonets and began to advance. They were about three paces from the prisoners, but still the Americans stood firm and refused to back down. The British gave the order to charge. The prisoners instantly broke and ran as fast as possible to the safety of their prison cells. There were thousands of Americans desperately trying to get back into the buildings, but they could not do so quickly. The order to fire was given. There is some doubt as to who by, but the Americans later insisted that it was Captain Shortland. The soldiers obeyed and fired a full volley. The volleys were repeated for several rounds, while prisoners falling dead and wounded all around. Not long after the War of 1812, Texas got into a scrap with Mexico, and General Santa Anna was trying to put the rebellion down by making the Texans fear his power. So he wasn't very kind to prisoners of war at all. In March of the year of the Texas independence, Santa Anna had quickly advanced and surrounded 300 men in the Texican army on the open prairie near Goliad. A two-day battle ensued, with the Texans holding their own on the first day. However, the Mexicans would receive overwhelming reinforcements and heavy artillery, and due to their critical predicament, Texan Colonel James Fannin and his staff had voted to surrender the Texas force on the 20th of March. They were led to believe that they would be released into the United States. They returned to the former fort of Goliad, now being their prison. They were held as prisoners at Fort Defense. The Texans thought they would likely be set free in a few weeks. General Urrea departed Goliad, leaving command to Colonel Jose Nicolas de la Portilla. Urrea wrote to Santa Anna to ask for clemency for the Texans. Urrea wrote in his diary that he wished to elude the orders as far as possible without compromising his personal responsibility. 1 week after their capture, Santa Anna ordered Portilla to execute the prisoners. The next day, Palm Sunday, March 27, 1836, Colonel Portilla had the 303 Texans marched out of Fort Defiance into three columns on the Bexar Road, San Patrico Road, and the Victoria Road between two rows of Mexican soldiers. They were shot point blank, and any survivors were clubbed and knifed to death. 40 Texans were wounded and unable to walk. 39 were killed inside the fort. And under the direction of Captain Carolina Hureto of the Trevilla Battalion, with Colonel Garay saving one, Colonel Fannin was the last to be executed. After seeing his men executed, At age 32, he was taken by Mexican soldiers to the courtyard in front of the chapel, blindfolded, and seated in a chair to do his leg wound from the battle. He made three requests. He asked for his personal possessions to be sent to his family, to be shot in his heart and not his face, and to be given a Christian burial. The soldiers took his belongings, shot him in the face, and burned his body along with the other Texans who died that day. With that war over, and Texas and New Mexico and Utah and Arizona and California now part of the United States, the next war that came along was the Civil War. In November of 1863, Confederate Captain Sidney Winer was sent to the village of Andersonville in Sumter County, Georgia, to assess the potential of building a prison for captured Union soldiers. The Deep South location, the availability of fresh water, and its proximity to the Southwestern Railroad made Andersonville a favorable prison location. In addition, Andersonville had a population of less than 20 people, and was therefore politically unable to resist the building of such an unpopular facility. In January of 1864, slaves from local farms were impressed to fell trees and dig ditches for construction of the prison stockade. The stockade enclosure was approximately 1,010 feet long and 780 feet wide. The walls of the stockade were constructed of pine logs cut on site, hewn square and set vertically in a wall trench dug roughly 5 feet deep. Included in the construction of the stockade were two gates positioned along the west stockade line. The gates were described in historic accounts as small stockade pens about 30 feet square, built of massive timbers with heavy doors. Prisoners began arriving at the prison in late February of 1864, and by early June, the prison population had climbed to 20,000. Consequently, it was decided that a larger prison was necessary, and by June, work was begun to enlarge the prison. Due to the threat of Union raids, Sherman's troops were marching on Atlanta already. General Winer ordered the building of defensive earthworks in a middle and outer stockade around the prison. The middle and outer stockades were hastily constructed of unhewn pine logs set vertically in wall trenches that were about 4 feet deep. By early September, Sherman's troops had occupied Atlanta, and the threat of Union raids on Andersonville prompted the transfer of most of the Union prisoners to other camps in Georgia and South Carolina. By mid-November, all but 1,500 prisoners had been shipped out of Andersonville, and only a few guards remained to police them. Transfers to Andersonville in late December increased the number of prisoners once again, and even then the prison population totaled only about 5,000 persons. The number of prisoners at the prison would remain this low until the war ended in April of 1865. During the 15 months during which Andersonville was operated, almost 13,000 Union prisoners died there of malnutrition, exposure, and disease. Andersonville became synonymous with the atrocities which both North and South soldiers experienced as prisoners of war.
Built on Georgia clay, and when I stepped inside the stockade walls, it took my breath away, and the stench came up so hard and fast, made my stomach roll.
in the sight that I looked up and saw, chilled me to my soul. At the sight of near 10,000 men, ground the pigs wouldn't own, half-starved and hollow-eyed, some just flesh and bone. Andersonville, pray that someone lives to tell how the devil came down to Georgia and built a perfect living hell.
You're listening to The Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll be right back.
The Veteran Next Door will return in a moment here on 100.3 WNOX.
Hello, Tennessee fans. This is Rick Terry with Rick Terry Jewelry Designs. And you know, I'm the official place for those wonderful fire opals, that Tennessee jewelry that you've never seen anywhere else. And I want to be your jeweler. And now, with two locations to serve you, Kingston Pike and Campbell Station Road, where we've been forever, and our second location in Lenoir City on Highway 321, Lenoir Mills Center. We're in the shopping center with the Brown Cup. Serving East Tennessee for over 22 years, I'm Rick Terry, and I want to be your jeweler.
Energize, detoxify, and hydrate six times faster with Hydrate Alkaline Ionized Water. Hydrate is available at the Veteran Next Door store at 4812 Asheville Highway and also available at your local Knoxville area Walgreens. Bottled at the source in Dandridge, Tennessee, this natural spring water and effective antioxidant reduces acid waste, hydrates cells quickly, and tastes delicious. Hydrate is a veteran-owned business and a proud sponsor of the Veteran Next Door. For more information about Hydrate Alkaline Ionized Water and the benefits it provides, visit www.historicsprings.com. That's historicsprings.com. Try it today.
Statements not evaluated by the FDA, nor meant to replace your doctor.
Randy Baxter, the host of The Veteran Next Door, is available to speak to your civic group, organization, your church, your school, or any group interested in the American veteran and what non-veterans can do to support them. Topics will include great stories from the Army, Marines, Air Force, and Navy, personal stories about our veterans, and ways to interview your personal veteran while you still can. Now, if you're looking for a dynamic speaker and a heartwarming desire to preserve our heritage and the heritage of all veterans, contact Randy Baxter to schedule your group's event. Call 865-525-2323 or contact Randall Baxter at randallbaxter.com or visit theveterannextdoor.com, our website, to get more information. Put Randy Baxter on your calendar today. Randy Baxter, the host of The Veteran Next Door, now available for your speaking engagement.
Now back to The Veteran Next Door on 100.3 WNOX.
Then came World War II. The German people, a lot of their prisoners of war, they thought were subhuman, and they really didn't think those people deserved much care. Their mission was to exterminate them anyway. But they did follow the Geneva Convention when it came, as much as they could, when it came to American prisoners of war or Allied prisoners of war, most of the time. Of course, there was the one little incident during D-Day when there were some American troops that had been captured in a little town called Malmedy, and the processing humane treatment of these prisoners would have slowed down the German timetable, and one of the German officers decided it'd be best just to take them out in the field and shoot them. And that became known as the massacre at Malmedy, and when the American soldiers found out about it, they began to stiffen their resistance because they didn't want to be captured if they were going to be shot. Also, the Germans had a couple of rules for pilots. If they shot down a pilot and captured him, and if he escaped, and we learned this from Mr. Bear, who was a P-51 pilot and a P-47 pilot, if you were captured and you escaped, if you were captured a second time, you would be treated as a spy and shot because you had been behind enemy lines. We had some POW camps here in the United States. We treated our prisoners pretty well here. If you ever go to Asheville, North Carolina and look at the Grove Park Inn, it's a nice big five-star hotel with a big golf course around it. And that was our prisoner of war camp for German diplomats. That's where we took all our diplomats when the war started and told them to stay there. They were allowed to go shopping. They were allowed to just have a normal life, but they had to stay in that five-star hotel for the course of the war. Not the whole war, but most of it. But we also had POW camps in Kansas. And one of my clients that I had been working with, I asked him what he did during World War II, and he said, oh, I didn't do much. I was a head of the commissary in a prisoner of war camp in Kansas. And I said, well, tell me about it. And he told me that toward the end of the war, the prisoners of war in the camps there were under a strict control by the Nazi officers. And the more reports that came in that were telling the German soldiers that the war was about to end and the Germans were losing the war, he said that sometimes in the mornings they would go walking down the street where the barracks were for the German soldiers, and they would find dead German officers in the street, beheaded. And what would happen was that the German soldiers would rebel against the Nazis that were inside the camp and would get rid of them. We also had POW camps in the South. Mostly we built our POW camps in the South because we didn't have to heat them. It was a lot cheaper to keep a camp in the South, and we would farm those prisoners of war out. Sometimes you would go into a restaurant in South Carolina and it would be full of German prisoners of war eating dinner inside the restaurant. They were brought to us a lot of times by ships, like the one that another one of our guests in the past, James Julian, who was a black sailor, had brought prisoners of war from the battles with the Africa Corps and had brought them around the Horn of Africa and into South Carolina. The Germans and the Russians had prisoner of war camps too, and they hated each other so bad that most of the Germans and Russians who were in the prisoner of war camps, Germans with the Russians and Russians with the Germans, never came home. They starved to death or went to Quilogs in the snow. And one thing that we need to be aware of is that there were death marches in Germany, and we learned that from John Schell when he was captured and was marched for 4 months because the Germans had run out of space or didn't have time to build more prisoner of war camps. And then there was a war on the other side of the world with the Japanese. And we all have heard the story of the Bataan Death March when Corregidor fell and the soldiers had to be marched. They were marched by the Japanese soldier who had no respect for them because they surrendered. The Bushido Code said that you do not surrender, you fight to the death. So they had no respect for an American or British soldier who would surrender in lieu of being killed. You've heard the story about the bridge over the River Kwai where the soldiers were used as slave labor. Although the movie wasn't very accurate, the fact is that the soldiers were used for slave labor. The Geneva Convention said that they were supposed to be paid the same wage as the soldiers of the army that held them prisoner. But that didn't happen very often. We didn't build too many prisoner of war camps for the Japanese. They weren't going to surrender. They would rather commit suicide or jump off a cliff when comparing that to the shame of being captured or surrendering. And at the same time, we had some prisoner of war camps in the United States full of Japanese. They weren't Japanese citizens. They were American citizens with Japanese parents. And let's listen to what was going on there.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, 2/3 of them American citizens. one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. Most were loyal. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
Evacuation. More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast State to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places. Different relocation centers in unsettled parts of California, Arizona, Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and Arkansas.
You're listening to The Veteran Next Door, and I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll be right back.
The Veteran Next Door will return in a moment here on 100.3 WNOX.
Hello, this is Randy Baxter, the host of The Veteran Next Door radio program. I'm also an advocate for U.S. senior vets. This next announcement is important to our listeners who have a parent or spouse who have served at least one day in the U.S. military during wartime. If this is you, please pay attention to this next announcement.
Do you have a grandparent, a parent, an aunt, an uncle, a sibling, a spouse who is a veteran of our armed forces and represented our country during wartime? The Aid in Attendance Benefit is a little-known Veterans Administration benefit offered to our heroes who fought in our wars. This benefit is also available to spouses of these same veterans. You must qualify for this benefit by submitting an application by meeting the criteria for qualification. For free information helping you find out if you qualify for this benefit, call 865-525-2323. You will receive the basic information to qualify for this benefit, as well as the next step procedures for application. Not all veterans qualify, but you need to be sure that you know what this benefit is all about so you will know when that time comes. Many family members may be suffering from the wear and tear and expense of providing services and care to a loved one who qualifies for this economic support. Take the first step. There is no cost to you to find out. Get your free information in the mail. Call 865-525-2323. There is no cost for this information. Just call and you will receive it in the mail. No salesman will call. World War II, Korean, and Vietnam veterans, and even our veterans from the Middle Eastern wars can qualify, but not if you don't take the first step. 525-2323. This service is provided by the sponsors of the Veteran Next Door radio show and is not working in association with the Veterans Administration. This service is free to all veterans.
Are you a company in need of marketing or branding? Let APN assist you in creating a marketing campaign for your company that will increase awareness and generate activity. APN is an interactive media and marketing agency focused on web design, social media campaigns, commercial printing, and video production. Please visit our website at apnmarketing.com today to schedule your free consultation and find out what APN can do for your company. Visit apnmarketing.com today.
Now back to The Veteran Next Door on 100.3 WNOX.
Welcome back to The Veteran Next Door, and I'm your host, Randy Baxter. When World War II was over, it wasn't long before we were in another scrape called Korea. And I introduced you a few weeks ago to Fred Chatfield and his family, and Mr. Chatfield had died as a prisoner of war in Korea. He had starved to death after being captured. But the Korean veterans who were prisoners of war had three choices. One is they may not survive their captivity. Two, they could come back to America when the war was over. Or three, and 22 American soldiers chose this path. They could choose to go live in China instead of coming back to America. And there are many reasons why they would want to do that. Some had been turned into communists. Some had been brainwashed. And some were afraid to come home because of things that they did during the war. And one or two were afraid to come home because of things they did before the war. So the Korean prisoner of war had three choices. And then the Cold War, we've talked about the Cold War before, and lots of times we would capture an enemy soldier or an enemy representative, might be calling them a spy, And we would deny that we captured him, or they would deny that he existed, or we would both deny that they even existed. And there we'd have a prisoner that no one would even admit had a right to even be around. And sometimes when our pilots were shot down, we would accuse the Russians of coming across the border and shooting him down, or they would accuse us of going across the border. And a lot of times we just didn't want to admit that we had crossed their border. So the Cold War prisoners of war at this time are classified. And then that brings us to Vietnam and the prisoner of war. And there, you know, I know everybody knows about Hanoi Hilton and the pilots that were being captured. But the other day I attended a class at McGee Tyson Air Base. I went as a guest to a former Sergeant Robinson, who's now Captain Robinson. He's about in his 70s right now. And he has the distinction of being one of the longest held non-commissioned officers held as a prisoner of war in American history. And he's going to be our guest in a couple of weeks. But he was the guest speaker at this class, and he was talking to, there were close to about 70 or 80 soon-to-be sergeants of the United States Air Force. And I listened to Mr. Robinson's speech, and he told them that they may be sitting in that chair today learning about the rules and regulations of being a sergeant in the Air Force. But a week from now, or even 2 weeks from now, they could find themselves being held captive in a foreign country and being a prisoner of war. And we all know that famous picture in Vietnam where the South Vietnamese general had captured during the Tet Offensive a Viet Cong soldier. And instead of taking him in, his hands were cuffed. He had already been captured. But it's a very famous picture of that general raising up his pistol and shooting that soldier in the side of the head. There are some codes of conduct for prisoners of war. President Dwight D. Eisenhower first published the Code of Conduct for members of the Armed Forces of the United States on August 17, 1955. The Code of Conduct outlines basic responsibilities and obligations of members of the U.S. Armed Forces. All members are expected to measure up to the standards embodied in the Code of Conduct. Although designed for a POW situation, the spirit and intent are applicable to service members subjected to other hostile detention. Such service members should consistently conduct themselves in a manner that avoids discrediting them and their country. There are six articles of the Code of Conduct that address situations in decision areas that, to some degree, may be encountered by all personnel. It includes basic information useful to POWs in their task of surviving honorably while resisting their captors' efforts to exploit them to the enemy's advantage and their disadvantage. Such survival and resistance require varying degrees of knowledge of what the six articles mean. The Code of Conduct, Article 1. I am an American, fighting in the forces which guard my country and our way of life. I am prepared to give my life in their defense. Article 2. I will never surrender of my own free will. If in command, I will never surrender the members of my command while they still have the means to resist. Article 3. If I am captured, I will continue to resist by all means available. I will make every effort to escape and aid others to escape. I will accept neither parole nor special favors from the enemy. If I become a prisoner of war, I will keep faith with my fellow prisoners. I will give no information or take part in any action which might be harmful to my comrades. If I am senior, I will take command. If not, I will obey the lawful orders of those appointed over me and will back them up in every way. When questioned, should I become a prisoner of war, I am required to give name, rank, service number, and date of birth. I will evade answering further questions to the utmost of my ability. I will make no oral or written statements disloyal to my country and its allies or harmful to their cause. Article 7. I will never forget that I am an American, fighting for freedom, responsible for my actions, and dedicated to the principles which made my country free. I will trust in my God and in the United States of America. Some Americans spent a long, long time in captivity. In my interviews with Mr. Robinson, again, as a gentleman you'll meet here in the next week or so, I asked him how long he had stayed as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. And he said, "Mr. Baxter, I remember 8 Christmases, 8 New Years, and 8 Thanksgivings." He said, "I was in my early 20s, and that sure is a lot of Saturday nights." In the Gulf War and Afghan War, the prisoners of war are used for political reasons.
Day 5 of Operation Desert Storm. This morning, many of us awoke to disturbing pictures from Baghdad of prisoners of war, U.S. and allied flyers shot down, captured by Iraq, paraded before Iraqi television. Latest word from Baghdad, those POWs will be scattered among targets around Iraq in hopes of deterring allied attacks, an act condemned by Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, who said they will not deter those attacks.
We also have a prisoner of war in Afghanistan who has been there for over 2 years. Listen to a message from his dad.
"I'm the father of captured U.S. soldier Beau Robert Bergdahl. These are my thoughts. I can remain silent no longer. I address the Pakistani Armed Forces. I personally appeal to General Kayani and General Pasha. Our family is counting on your professional integrity and honor to secure the safe return of our son, and we thank you. Our family knows the high price that has been paid by your men in the Army and the Frontier Corps. We give our condolences and thanks to the families of those who have fallen for Pakistan. Strangely to some, we must also thank those who have cared for our son for almost 2 years. Mullah Sanjeen, the Haqqanis, and others who have played a role in sheltering the American prisoner. We know our son is a prisoner and at the same time a guest in your home. We understand the rationale the Islamic Emirate has made through its videos. No family in the United States understands the detainee issue like ours. Our son's safe return will only heighten public awareness of this. That said, our son is being exploited. It's past time for Beau and the others to come home. To the nation of Pakistan, our family would wish to convey our compassionate respect. We have watched the violence of war, earthquake, epic floods, and crop failures devastate your lives, all while our son has been in captivity. We have watched your suffering through the presence of our son in your midst. We have wept that God may show his beneficence, his mercy, and that his peace may come upon the people of Pakistan. Assalamu alaikum. We ask that your nation diligently help our son be freed from his captivity. I pray this video may be shown to our only son. Tare meshi bo. Assalamu alaikum. God bless you. We love you. We've been quiet in public, but we haven't been quiet behind the scenes. Continue to be patient and kind to those around you. Hear na, Abo. Hear na. You're not forgotten. You are not forgotten.
You've been listening to The Veteran Next Door. I'm your host, Randy Baxter, and we'll see you next week.
I never was a soldier, but I played one as a child. History was good to me. I grew up free and wild.
You've been listening to Randall Baxter and the Veteran Next Door. Be sure to join us again next Sunday morning at 9 here on 100.3 WNOX.
Are you a veteran? Or maybe your parents or grandparents were? Go to theveterannextdoor.com. That's theveterannextdoor.com for access to past military records, information on the aid and attendance benefit, or to order past copies of the show. That's theveterannextdoor.com. That's theveterannextdoor.com. Check it out. You'll be glad you did.
If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact Randall Baxter at randallbaxter.com or call 865-525-2323. A copy of the show is only $6 plus sales tax and freight, or you can pick them up at the Veteran Next Door store at 4812 Asheville Highway. Copies can be purchased as individual shows, multiple copies of the same show, or as a series. What better way to share time with the kids than by listening to the experiences of people who actually lived through historic events, like the Battle of the Bulge, World War I, Knoxville during the Civil War, Vietnam as told by soldiers who were there, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Afghanistan, and Islam in the 20th century. Each show is hosted by the Veteran Next Door host, Randy Baxter, describing the history-making events and introducing you to people who experienced the event firsthand. Purchase the shows one at a time or in sets by topic or mix and match to suit your learning needs. The complete World War II series of 9 shows is only $27 plus tax and freight. For a list of available shows, call 865-525-2323 or contact Randall Baxter at randallbaxter.com.